Welcome to Sports and a Slice of Life. And now, here's your host, Dave Lewis.
I'm fired up about this. In fact, let me take a little bit of his very last column. Let me tell you a story. Once there was a kid from an Ohio small town who would sit in his family's basement rec room and watch sports. Mm-hmm. He would see the Olympics, Super Bowl, World Series, U.S. Open Golf Tournament, and the NCAA Final Four. They seemed to take place on some sort of fantasy planet. He wondered what it would be like to actually see those things in person, what it would sound like and feel like. Then all of a sudden, he was right there. Mark Purdy was there for a long time for the San Jose Mercury News. How you doing?
I'm at the top of my game, Dave. And thank you for saying I did it for a long time and not saying he's really old. So he saw 32 Super Bowls and 14 Olympics. You know,
I left out grizzled veteran.
Yeah, grizzled veteran. Yeah. Yeah. So, thanks. Thanks. I really was a lucky guy to be born at the right time when newspaper columnists did travel a lot and did get to do, see a lot of things. It's not so much the case anymore. And so I feel very, very fortunate that I was born at a time when I could enter the field and get into that wing of it and be able to do what I was, you know, paid to do. Not only did I see those things, I got paid to go. So that was a pretty good deal.
You moved to San Jose back in 1984. You come from that little small town, I believe, Salina, right?
Salina. It's, yeah.
Salina.
C-E-L-I-N-A. Yeah, pronounced Salina. A lot of people get it.
7,000 people.
Yeah.
Did you know at that time, were you looking for a place you could stay forever?
No. Well, I'll try to sum it up as quick as possible. I moved out here in 1984. I was 32 years old. I thought I was set at that time. I was working as a sports columnist for the Cincinnati Enquirer. And they were sending me to a lot of places, maybe not quite as many as the Mercury News would eventually do. But, you know, I was settled in there. I'd been the sports columnist there for 6 years. I developed a really good relationship with the people in Cincinnati that covered a lot of really cool things there with the kind of the end of the Big Red Machine. The Bengals went to the Super Bowl while I was there. Big college basketball area, and I love college basketball. And I had a wife and kid, and we were, you know, I figured that's where I'd spend the rest of my career. But then a guy named John Rawlings called me up. He was the sports editor here in San Jose and said, hey, I want to talk to you about this job in San Jose. And I sort of knew where San Jose was, but I wasn't that familiar with. And he said, fly out and we'll talk about it. Came out. I saw what they were trying to do here. At that time, they were trying to really upgrade the sports section and make it on a competitive level with the other major newspapers in California. And that summer, if you remember, in 84, there was the LA Olympics were here, the baseball All-Star game was here, and the Super Bowl was scheduled here for the end of the 84 season in January 85 at Stanford. And he pitched that to me and said, you know, it's all out in front of you. You come here. And so I told him no. I told him no because, you know, I said, we just had a baby, happy in Cincinnati. This is great. But, you know, I'm really looking for a place to spend the rest of my career. And I think, you know, Cincinnati's probably it. And he said, okay, and thanked me. And I think they offered the job to some other people. And then those people didn't take it either. So he called me back like two, three months later and said, hey, our job's still open. We'd still love to have you. Have you changed your mind? You want to fly out here and talk about it again? I said, no, I really don't. But, you know, I tell you what, I don't want to tell you, some other things were going on in Cincinnati too at that time. There was a change in management there. I wasn't sure where that was going. And I said, fly my wife out there, show her around. And if she likes it, you know, we'll move. So they flew her out, treated her like the queen she deserved to be treated as. And she came back and said, you know what? I think we could do this if we could make the money work. And so here's a negotiating tip for you kids. I got in touch with my accountant and said, how much would it cost to live in San Jose versus Cincinnati? What do I need to make there to match the standard of living here? And he gave me the number. I went back to Mercury News and said, here's the number. And they said, great, you know, and we'll give you a little bit more than that. So then I said, yes. That's probably more than you want to know, but it was a tough choice because I didn't mention this part. Barb was pregnant at the time too. She was due in October of 84. So this is the spring of 84. And so it ended up, I did come out. Things obviously worked out great. And my son was born during the fourth inning of the 1984 World Series. I went to the first two games in San Diego and said, I got to come home. My baby, you know, my wife's baby's due, and our baby's due, and came back. And so our son was born while I was there, which was great. That's more than you want to know. But
nowadays people would go online to see that cost of living conversion. So
yeah. That's what you got to do. And even, you know, certainly today. And even back then, I was smart enough for that. But what I did not realize is that I was moving to the most interesting place on in America. I mean, I really think Silicon Valley at that time, 1984, was just kind of in the larva stage, right? Apple had just kind of started up. Of course, Google and Facebook, none of those companies were here, but Intel was. And what I didn't realize was how many interesting people I would meet both in and out of sports here, and what an educated audience I would be writing to. They're really smart people that live in this area, and they won't put up with crappy writing. And so that I had to raise my game for that, which was terrific. And then, of course, we had the great 49er teams I covered. I had known Bill Walsh a little bit before. He'd been an assistant in Cincinnati with the Bengals. I'd known him a little bit, and then, of course, got to know him really well here, of course. And then, you know, the Giants had some great teams there. The A's ended up going to three straight World Series. So many great Olympic athletes here that I got to cover. The Sharks show up, right? And I could not have imagined that. And so that's how it ended up happening. What was the question?
I forget. How are you? I think is what it was.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about that with the Sharks coming, because Bud Geraci, I know you'll blush about this one, because he talks about how important you've been to San Jose sports as an advocate, where they should even put a trophy, not a trophy, but a statue of Mark Purdy outside the SAP Center because of you being such an advocate.
Yeah. Well, God love Bud. He's one of my good friends, and it's a little over the top for me to kind of ponder. Look, Dave, you know, if you work hard, like you work hard, you're proud of what you do. If you succeed in kind of your mission to work hard and do as best a job as you can, you're proud of what you do. But I'm proud of what I do, but I'm very humble about this honor that they're going to induct me in the San Jose Sports Hall of Fame. I know they've never inducted a journalist. And I, of course, wonder why that is. And people have said some very nice things. Yes, when I moved here, I would ask questions like, well, this is soon to be the 10th largest city in America. Where are the major league sports facilities, right? And why are people here content with driving 40 or 50 miles to go see Major League Baseball or NFL football or the Warriors why can't we have those things here? We put up with a lot of the other big city stuff, the bad traffic and you know, San Jose's a pretty safe city, but there's crime here. There's, you know, the big city issues. So why don't we have some of the cool stuff that big cities have? And I never got a good answer to that, other than the city council was worried about other things. So in the late 80s, the talk kind of bubbled up about actually a guy named John Neese, who was head of one of the big unions here, kind of got things going like, you know, we should get a sports arena here. And then some other grassroots things happened. And you're right. I started writing obnoxiously about this. I think if I'd written about it less, they might have happened sooner, because people got to writing about it. And, you know, I said, why are we against doing stuff here that has fun? We're building all this stuff that is necessary for big city. Why don't we build something fun, right? And at the time, there was no talk of an NHL expansion franchise. I just thought if they built an arena, they'd get NCAA games. It'd be some place where Stanford or Cal could play some college games. You know, the Warriors might come down here and play some games. And so I kept writing about this. And eventually, the mayor of San Jose, Tom McHenry, decided to go ahead with that and pushed it. He deserves a lot of credit. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, the arena was a ballot issue, and it almost failed. It passed, but it was behind, like I remember earlier in the evening, and behind the polls early, and then it eventually did pass. And then only then did the NHL talk about bringing a team here. And I obviously supported that because I thought, you know, it'd be a great place for families to go, you know, have a major league sports team in town to go see. So that was really cool and fun to cover, just watching that whole process evolve. Here's a trivia note. So the guy who first wanted, you know, I love telling stories. I guess you figured that out. The guy who first really wanted an NHL team in San Jose was a guy named Howard Baldwin, who was one of the, he was a Hollywood producer. He was one of the producers of the movie Hoosiers. And he had owned the Hartford Whalers at one point, had sold them and moved out to LA. And so I had heard about this. So when I was covering a Giants Dodgers end of the season, important series or something, you know, I had a free day and I called up his office. I said, you know, Mr. Baldwin there, I'm a sports columnist from San Jose. I hear you want to bring a team to San Jose. So he says, yeah, come on over. So I drove his office is on Rodeo Drive, you know, next to Zanuck Productions. And here's Baldwin, you know, and I go in and I sit down. I say, so tell me about this. What? Well, he had the whole plan laid out and he had gotten permission from the NHL to be San Jose, be the Bay Area's expansion owner when they expanded. And he had already contacted American Airlines and he had figured out that American Airlines would pay for the naming rights at the arena. The team was going to be called the San Jose Americans and he was going to have red, white, and blue uniforms. This is all set. And I said, really? Okay. What's the timetable? And he laid it out. Well, so that was going to happen. But then the Gund brothers, George and Gordon Gund, who had owned the California Seals and then had taken them back to Cleveland and then to Minnesota, where they were the Minnesota Stars, they got involved and said, well, we still own the NHL rights to the Bay Area because we were the last team there and we never gave up those rights. So now the NHL has a feud and I'm going like, oh, man, so this is just, you know, not going to happen. Well, they worked out, I'll never forget, Howard Baldwin called me and said, Mark, I've worked out the global solution. I said, so people in Beijing are going to care about this? He goes, no, I'm going to take over the Minnesota North Stars and they're going to get the rights to the Bay Area. And so that's how George Gund became the first owner. He came here and looked at all the different possibilities. Tom McHenry talked him into coming and playing with the Sharks. Gunn had to throw in an extra $50 million to upgrade the original arena plans to make it fit hockey. And that's how they became the Sharks instead of the San Jose Americans.
What was it like for you the first time you went to that arena to see your beloved Los Tiburones? Right?
Los Tiburones de San Jose? I don't know if I've ever told this story before, but I actually went in that arena before it was done. I like snuck in. You know, I just kind of wanted to see. They were still like, you know, it was still under most. It was probably 90% done. And I snuck in there. And I remember, you know, walking up. Nobody caught me. And I didn't have a hard hat. You're supposed to have a hard hat. I didn't have a hard hat. I just wanted to go in and eyeball it. And I remember sitting I walked up into, I don't know if they had seats. I might have sat on the concrete in one of the lower sections. And I just sat there and thought, you know, this could really be a game changer for downtown San Jose, because downtown San Jose at that time was not what it is today. And nobody went to downtown San Jose. When the Sharks did their marketing survey, the biggest thing they found was that people didn't dislike downtown San Jose. They'd just never been there. Nobody had been there. And so, and I thought about something that actually came to fruition, you know, since, you know, San Jose is this, urban suburban mongrel municipality of great ethnic restaurants and you know, different types of people, but there was never like kind of a common place for people to gather. I guess you'd say, you know, downtown Chavez Plaza when they have a festival there, but this would be like on a regular basis. You know, people could show up here for not just hockey, but the circus, the ice shows, concerts, whatever. And this concourse could become kind of like melting pot of all these people coming here to have a good time. And I remember sitting there thinking like this, if they don't screw this up, this could actually be very cool. And so it turned out it was. And that's really what made me happy. You know, when the, it was, actually, it was in terms of hockey, it was more fun to kind of see that first team playing at the Cow Palace with San Jose's name on it, right? Because I thought, this is the wildest thing ever, right? There's San Jose team playing sort of in San Francisco and in this old building where they have rodeos, right? And I thought, but it's really happening. And then when they moved to the arena and made the playoffs the first year and beat Detroit, you know, that was pretty cool. And that kind of cemented that the Sharks were going to be here a while.
Who are some of those guys in that first team? I remember the one guy, the bruiser, the one that was known for fighting.
Frank Gates.
There you go.
Frank Gates. I remember the draft, the day they drafted, it was this convoluted thing, but the expansion part, and then they got some people from Minnesota, and the guy Chuck Grillo, who was their main scout. So I'm asking him about the guys, and I bring up, well, what about this Link Gates guy? He goes, like, he's the meanest man in hockey, and you can quote me. So I said, well, thank you very much, I will. And and he was a mean guy and a big guy, big bruiser. And he had his reputation preceded him. He'd like shot out a church window in Peoria or something. And he knew what his role was. And unfortunately, he had some issues with alcohol. And so he was here, what, 2 or 3 years and got in a bad auto accident. But those years at the Cow Palace when he was a reason people loved going to the games. You know, people can say they don't like fighting, but he had some skill too. But the Sharks had a lot of young guys, of course, and he took care of them. Like if you took a run at them, he would take a run at you, which is kind of the way hockey works. But he was one of those characters. Pat Falloon was their first draft pick. I remember him. And whenever he get the puck, people would yell, Falloon. You know, it was fun. There was Kelly Kissio, was I think the captain. Oh, Doug Wilson, who's now general manager. One of the last guys to play without a helmet, which was kind of weird. Who other guys on that team I liked? The goalie. Well, eventually, he played the first season a little bit. Archer Zerbe, the goalie, you know, from Latvia.
He was a fan favorite.
He was.
People loved him.
Great guy, and he had. He had been involved in politics in Latvia and actually participated in the demonstrations where they faced down the Russian tanks. And he was a very bright guy and always an interesting interview. And they've never really brought back those guys for a reunion. This is the 30th. It was 1991 was their first team. We're in 2021. I know we had the pandemic last year, but they haven't announced that they're having a 30th reunion, but man, it'd be fun to see at least some of those guys again. I think Falloon lives in he's from a little town in Fox Warren, Manitoba. And I think he's still there now farming or something. It'd be really fun to see him. And Ray Whitney was on that team too. And he ended up having a long career in the NHL. He was like their second round pick. This is all Sharks trivia that probably nobody except you and me care about, but I wish they'd have a reunion.
I wanted to ask you because of all the sports you cover, and I really pretty much believe this too. The hockey guys, I think, are the best guys. They seem to be the most accessible, friendly, down to earth.
Well, and that is their reputation, and it's deserved for the most part. But you know, Dave, I found every team I covered, you know, and I covered every sport, and pretty much every level. But when you get to the pro level, in particular. Every locker room has some really great guys in it. And every locker room has some assholes in it. Yeah. Right? And then a lot of guys are just kind of there. Right. But so people ask like, well, who do you root for? Well, you know, you root for the good guys to do well. You don't root for the assholes to do poorly, but it's like, you know, I don't care. I mean, And then the other guys you want to get to, maybe I'm wrong about these guys. Maybe they do have something to offer. Let me try to get to know them better, right? To see if they, and a lot of times they did have interesting stories. And the hockey guys in particular, because a lot of them were international. So remember Igor Larionov?
Yeah.
Yeah. He had one of the last players for this that wore like the Soviet Union. Really bright guy and really funny. Sergei Makarov was there, you know, and he didn't like the media. So whenever you'd approach him, he'd go like, never talking, always never talking, always never talking. I'm like, well, does that mean you're always talking? You know, but, and, but he liked to surf. I found out he liked to surf. And so he actually talked to me a little bit about surfing and how much he likes surf. Surfing Sergey, I would call him. And Lariana was a clever guy. And one time when he was, he lived, I think he lived in Los Altos, so he had to drive to downtown San Jose from Los Altos. And they pulled him over for driving solo in the carpool lane. And he told the highway patrol guy, I thought this, it says pool, and I'm on my way to my therapy pool. And I thought this is for people to go into the therapy pool. And I'm sorry, you know. And I said, did he really buy the officer buy that? And Igor goes like, no, didn't buy it. Nice try. So they were really interesting guys. And because I think because they aren't covered as much as the NFL and baseball, and that since there aren't as many people around, you get a chance to have more of a one-on-one relationship with a lot of those guys. So that was fun.
You covered so many big events, but you're known as a great storyteller too. So is there a story out there that you were proud to tell that you can maybe stick your chest out and say, you know what, man, this is kind of beyond the box score or just a great human interest story?
Well, you know, I am so fortunate to have the job I have. I mean, I worked hard, but you know, you have to be in the right place at the right time and work for the right people. But I've said I might be the only, every sports writer probably has some version of this, but I might be the only guy that's had lunch with Muhammad Ali, played golf with Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, had drinks with Hunter S. Thompson, the guy, what was the fourth one? I don't know, but you know, came face to face with Fidel Castro at a bowling alley in Cuba. All right,
I don't. 1991.
Yes, those four things. Some people might have done one of those. Some people might have done two of those, but like the combination of those four together, I can't imagine any other human being has had those four experiences, right? And so very, very lucky, you know, of those four, the Fidel Castro story is probably the best. It was because I was covering the Pan American Games in 1991. The bowling is a Pan American Games sport, not an Olympic sport. But Cuba had banned bowling because when Fidel took over, the only, and still maybe today, the only two companies in the world to make bowling equipment are American companies, Brunswick and AMF. Right. And so they didn't do business with America. So they had no bowling there. So when they got the Pan American Games, they had to have bowling and they couldn't work out an arrangement with the State Department over that. So Fidel got this Mizuno, I think a Japanese company, come in and build its first bowling alley. They got in the bowling business. It was great. It was this beautiful bowling. It was like the most modern building in Havana. And so I'm not the brightest guy, but I know that's a pretty good story. Right. So we show up with a couple other sports writers to cover the bowling. Cuba, of course, is terrible because they've never had bowling. So these guys are, but people are fascinated to see bowling. The Cubans, they've never seen bowling before. It's just an exotic sport. We got to go see bowling. So they would line up around the block to get in to see the bowling. Hilarious, right? And so we go there and they say, well, good. We haven't opened the doors yet. You guys go sit there in those seats right there. That's where we're putting the press, right there in the middle, these middle seats. Behind there, there were like, I don't know, maybe 8-10 rows of bleachers behind them. And so we go there, and then the bowlers come out and they're warming up, and just like about 10 minutes before it's supposed to start, this usher comes down now and goes, Lo siento, señores, I'm sorry, sirs, there are important officials coming, you must move. And in Spanish, and I had my friend Jorge Diaz from the Orlando paper is sitting next to me, and he's fluent. And so he's like arguing with this usher. You don't understand. We're important American writers. We're here to cover your magnificent bowling facility. I don't know what he can say. And they're going, and this woman's getting like really angry. And I could see like, let's just calm down. Let me go talk to the, you know, the person who told us to sit here and they can come back. And just then we turn around and it's like an Army Navy store exploded in our face. Down the aisle come these guys in camouflage gear holding guns. And in the middle of it is Fidel. And Fidel, because Fidel wanted to see bowling today. And the things you learn, Dave. I've been to events where the U.S. president shows up, right? President, going back to President Ford. And the way they do that is like the day before they bring in the police dog, they sweep the place. They call it sterilizing so that like nobody can be there hiding or no bombs can be planted for the president. Fidel has the different philosophy. Like if nobody knows where I'm going, nobody can be there waiting to kill me. Right. So he didn't tell anybody where he's going until like 10 minutes beforehand. Well, he decided he was going to go to bowling and now he needed a seat. Here's the, and we're in his seats. So I get up and I'm moving down to the aisle. And it occurs to me, I'm going to come face to face with this guy, right? One of the, you know, leading dictators in the world or whatever. And so I say to Jorge, I said, you know, what do you think I could shake his hand? He goes like, you don't want to make this move to Fidel because they got guys that, you know, the CIA tried to assassinate him with a fountain pen or something, right? You know, so just, so, okay, fine. So I come face to face. He's actually a little taller than me and I'm 6'1" and he's like 6'2". And, you know, we're like this. And he looks at me and he goes, I go like, and he goes down and puts his butt where I was sitting. And so, you know, Jorge says, what do we do now? I said, well, I've got my column, you know, but they found some seat. They threw some poor average people out of the next section and let us sit there. And Fidel goes, el bolo, andale, andale, you know, so let's start bowling. And so I had my lead for the next day, which was Dateline Havana. Fidel took my seat, period, paragraph, right? I figure if I can't get people to the second paragraph with that lead, I'm in the wrong business, right? And I just told the whole story. And so that was, you know, that's probably my favorite story to tell. One I haven't told, I don't know. I have to think about that. I do want to go back. I haven't done this yet. I don't want to go back over through my old columns and maybe do just for my like grandkids, you know, put together, you know, the best or the ones I thought were, you know, the 50 or 60 ones I thought were the most interesting and just so they could see it. And I don't know, somebody said you ought to publish that. I don't know if they'd buy it, but, there were great moments.
Oh, I mean, Jim Murray had a great book with his best stuff.
Yeah, but that was Dave. That was Jim Murray. I'm this guy in San Jose, right? There's another fortunate thing, right? So early in my career, I worked a year and a half at the LA Times covering UCLA football and basketball, 1977-78. So, you know, I got to sit on planes next to John Wooden, right? And, you know, think about that. And, that the best part about that to me was at certain events, I got to sit next to Jim Murray, just saw how he worked, saw how he really, how he grinded, you know, which really made an impression on me. Like this guy is such a great sports writer. If your listeners don't realize, I mean, he was the best for many years, and just the way he would approach his task and, you know, grinding, like really making sure every sentence was compact and said exactly what he wanted it to say. And when I left the LA Times to go write columns in Cincinnati, I said, do you have like 15 minutes that I could talk to you about writing columns? Cause I was a beat guy. And he said, yeah. What do you want to know? And he gave me like an hour. Right. And how can you put a price on that? You can't. How can you put a price on having lunch with Muhammad Ali? You know, that was, you know, there are funny stories about that too, but, so I'm so blessed. I'm really blessed. So, I'm pretty sure I don't belong in the San Jose Sports Hall of Fame with the other people that are there. If you look at the other people that are there,
Those names, all right? Yeah. George Seifert, Summer Sanders,
yeah,
James Jones, and you.
Yeah, those are the inductee class this year. But if you go back, you know, the other people in there, Jim Plunkett, you know, Jack and John Elway, because John played at Stanford when Jack was here. At coaching at San Jose State and later Stanford, Randy Chastain, all these great athletes, and Bill Walsh, all these great athletes names that have passed through this camp. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, you know, two of the most historic sports figures of the 20th century, who I've also got to met in an interview. I mean, think about that. That's really special. So I'm pretty sure I don't belong in there with these people, but I'm really humbled to think that the committee believes I have a place there. I mean, I haven't put together my speech yet, but it's going to be very short because I know nobody's coming there to see me talk, but I may tell a couple stories, but I want to accept it on behalf of all the people who have told stories about who have captured and chronicled and told stories about San Jose and South Bay athletes over the years. I want to accept on behalf of all those people. The way I see it, I'm just representing them, and I am just beyond humbled to think I'm the only journalist in there.
Right? How did you find out about this?
I guess somebody called me. I don't know. I think Kerry Benjamin from the Hall of Fame, who runs the banquet, runs the dinner, called me.
What'd you think?
It was last year during the pandemic, right? And I said, no, really? And, I had been involved. When I retired in 2017, I had been involved in the process of picking the Hall of Famers. And I had contributed like scripts for the video stuff they do there. So I knew how it worked. And so that made it even more amazing when I got the call. Like, so 3 years after I left the board, I got the call, and I thought Kerry was calling because she wanted me to help her out with something else with the dinner. And it turned out, they actually were going to induct me, which is pretty amazing.
So you'll have a bust in the concourse then at the SAP Center?
Yeah, they do. They don't do busts. They do like plaques with your kind of 3D kind of my face, right? So my kids have been giving me grief about that, right? You send in like three or four pictures, and then the guy who does it or the woman who does it does those in half. So I'm hoping it looks more like you than me.
Haven't seen it yet.
You're a much better looking guy I am.
Huh? Oh, please. They're not going to mess it up like they did Brandy's then.
Well, Brandy's, now that was the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
The San Jose Sports Hall of Fame, her plaque has always looked like her. And which it should, because she's a San Jose native all the way. And, we talked too long here, but I do think, and I think I want to touch on this in the induction speech, there's something about this area. I'm talking about the South Bay, Silicon Valley, San Jose, that spawns kind of pioneer type people, like some of the soup here, much like the high tech stuff. People take chances here and are like Tommy Smith and John Carlos, right? Bill Walsh, he was a real risk taker, pioneer person. Brandi Chastain, at the time she came up, women's soccer wasn't what it became, and she was one of the reasons it became what it became, right? Jim Plunkett, the first Mexican American to win a Super Bowl at quarterback, right? There are all these people that were pioneers in what they did. And there's something in the soup here that's kind of, I think, open to that sort of thing. And the rest of the Bay Area obviously has produced great athletes too. But I think there's something down here in the South Bay that kind of lends itself to that. I never totally put my finger on it, but I firmly believe it.
Got to be humbling for you to be.
Yeah, it's very humbling. But here's another example. There's a woman, the first female Olympian from the Bay Area was from here, and she competed in the first Olympics that women could compete in, and now I'm gonna blank on her name. She was from Santa Clara, and I'll think of it in a minute. And she was a javelin and discus thrower. And she set the world female record for javelin. If you give me a minute, I'll think of her name. But weren't going to have javelin in the Olympics for the women. So she decided she switched to discus. And she talked the Stanford basketball coach, or excuse me, the Stanford track and field coach into coaching her into how to throw the discus. And
Margaret Jenkins.
Margaret Jenkins. Thank you. I was just trying to look it up here while we're talking. Absolutely. Margaret Jenkins, and later became a school teacher in Santa Clara. And to research her story and find out about her. I mean, there's another example, right? The first woman in the Bay Area to compete in the Olympics, in the first Olympics. How many cities or regions contributed? I think there were only like maybe 20 women from the U.S. that competed in that first Olympics, that the, what, like 1928, I think, maybe. and 1924. And I had to look it up. But man, I never got to sit down and interview that woman, but I would have loved to do so. And that's another example. If you, you know, you look at, it's not an accident that, you know, you've got people like Brandi Chastain, Kerry Walsh, who will be the rule is you got to be retired 3 years before you're inducted. She'll certainly be as soon as she's eligible, but she was competing. I think she tried to make the Olympics again this summer and was competing and then did not make the team. But people like that, people like Margaret Jenkins, you know, on the female side of things, were let alone all the great athletes at Stanford. You know, they're again, that kind of risk element, open to taking chances. What the hell? Let's do it. I think that contributed to that too.
One thing I wanted to ask you about your writing, and you had so many great stories, but one thing I always looked forward to was this letter segment. So people would ask you questions and you'd have some nice little, you know, interaction, but at the end, eventually someone would tell you, you suck basically. And then you'd wrap it up.
Many people,
but that was fun.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, again, don't tell anybody. So that was a cheap way of getting a column every time. I didn't have to write it, right? All these people wrote in. So I just edited their letters and put responses to them. And I didn't have to come up with an idea that day. Right. But that was okay. You know, sports is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be, we lose. I worry that these days it's becoming less fun because a number of things we don't need to go into, but you know, that I didn't mind people. You're supposed to argue about sports. I don't mind about that. You know, and my dad, who was a small town attorney judge, also was a high school basketball referee. And I would go with him on like Friday nights to these little steamed up window gyms in northwestern Ohio, northeastern Indiana. And he would referee these games. And I'd be like 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, and but he told me then, look, you're going to hear people yell stuff at me, you know, call me names. But keep in mind when they do that, they're not saying you're a so-and-so. What they're saying is that call you made makes me think you are a so-and-so, right? It's different. If our next door neighbor who we know thinks I'm a jerk, then I got to listen to that. And I got to, you know, accept that and try to figure out how not to be a jerk. Right. But, you know, the rest is just that's sports. So when I got into this job and people would call me names or send me these nasty letters, I always I would have like death threats on my window at like Raider games, you know.
What for?
I don't know. Because I knew interestingly the Raiders fans would misspell obscene words more than anybody. I don't know how that works. But anyway, because they just cared a lot, right? And I wasn't too concerned that, I don't know, would a death threat be like, watch your effing back and we know where you live and we're going to come after you? I guess that's sort of, I don't know. But that my experience with my dad had taught me, okay, those people don't know me. they're reading what I wrote and I made them mad for something I wrote. And if I always wanted to be accurate, right? And I always wanted to be fair. But if I write this and somebody takes it way too seriously, I'm not going to get too upset about that. I would feel for my family sometimes. They would have to deal with that. But I think anybody in the field probably has dealt with that. That's fine. I didn't. Oh, so I twisted it and would turn it into a column, right? These people that were, you know, upset at me. One of my favorites was one time I wrote something about somebody had spit in somebody's face in the bottom of a football pile and sparked like a scuffle or something. And I wrote, you know, I forget which player it was. Somebody, I said, he must have learned his manners at the sewage plant, right? By spitting in his face. So like later that week, I get a letter back. This is the days we were like letter from the guys at the sewage plant. how dare you insult us sewage plant workers? We never spit in anybody's faces. You know, what a jerk you are to imply sewage plant workers have bad manners. But, well, the guy's got a point. So they were taking it the fun way, and so was I.
With this, all this happening before social media, how would that have changed, you know, your last few years of writing and interacting with the audience, et cetera?
Good question. And I don't know. I mean, I caught a lot of that before I retired in 2017. I think unfortunately to me, the way you have to respond to it today is because people are very, very impatient. I don't think they sit down and read what people have to say anymore. They're responding, you know, it's only important what happened in the last 15 minutes and whether somebody sucked or was the best ever in the last 15 minutes or might be in the next 15 minutes, rather than having perspective and, you know, kind of putting things in context, right? I understand why that's happening. You've got to adjust to the audience. The audience is what pays you, really. And so I just think it's too bad, because I think people, I don't know if Jim Murray could get a job today, because he was a brilliant writer who did have a lot of perspective and would bring, you know, these interesting thoughts in there. And instead, people want to know, you know, is Jimmy G losing control of the locker room, right? You know, well, I'm more interested, like last night, I was more interested. Nobody asked the question, how many times had Garoppolo played in weather like that? We're talking the morning after the day after the 49ers.
The ball clearly slipping out of his hands.
Colts game where he played in terrible weather. But Garoppolo grew up outside Chicago. He played in Illinois, you know. I mean, put that in context. Was there a game where he had was like as bad as this, and how did he do? And so, put it in context. How does put yourself in other people's shoes and try to figure out some different question that maybe somebody had, you know. I think the one thing, and I'll tell it real quick, and then we probably got to shut up. But the thing, I'll tell you one thing that kind of pushed me over when I was thinking about retiring. And so in the spring of 2017, the Warriors are in the NBA Finals. And it's the year after Draymond Green had been suspended for the game and the Warriors had lost to the Cavaliers. So this spring, they're playing the Cavaliers again. They're beating them. And so after the first or second game, now this is the other difference thing. Used to be, you go talk to guys in the locker room afterwards, it's just you and them, or it's a group of guys, and you can have dialogue back and forth. Now everything is staged in the post-game interviews, and you have a microphone, and they have a microphone, and you're in a crowd, and, you know, it's like they've turned the journalism part, what I try to do, into like part of the show, which I detest. I mean, I've had guys yell at me in the locker room a lot, because sometimes I ask stupid questions, but then I'll deal with it, right? In this case, so I asked Draymond, you know, last year you got, I'm paraphrasing, but you actually go find this in YouTube somewhere. Last year you were suspended that game. This year you've avoided getting technical fouls. And, it's something that's noticeable. Could you tell me about your mental approach to this and why it's happening this way this time, right? And he's sitting on a podium next to Kevin Durant. And Draymond just goes off for whatever reason. You know, I don't know if you want to put on a show. He says, Jesus Christ, you're talking like I'm the worst person on earth, and I'm all I ever do is get a five thing, you know. And I just calmly said, no, I want to know if this is a conscious thing on your part, whether you made a real conscious effort to not be that guy you were a year ago where you got suspended, you know. Well, you don't know. And then Durant jumps in for some reason. He goes like, you want him to do that. You want him to do that. And I said, no, I just want him to answer the question, right? And all this is caught on live TV, right, because of the way things are now. And so finally Draymond, you know, pauses, kind of sighs, and then he gives a good answer. He gives like a really good answer. Well, I know I'm not helping the team when I do it the other way. And yes, and it was a good answer. So I had the answer for my column. I sat down and wrote a column about this and why things, Draymond's have changed and why, you know, it's different this year than last year. And this is why the Warriors are probably going to win this finals, and they did. Okay, so the next day I get up, and everything is now on our score. You know, I call it the scoreboard, where we see how many people are clicking onto your stories. And I get up, and you know, there's like, I don't, I'll pull a number out of the head, but it's like something like, you know, 175,000 people have read this column I wrote about Draymond Green not punching somebody in the balls and you know, getting suspended, and why that's happening. And I try to explain, you know, I'm happy with that, right? Then I go and I see this exchange he and I had is on YouTube, and that has like 500,000 views. Right. And so people would rather see that than read something with context and perspective about what it all means. Why did he answer it that way? Right. Why did he? And I thought, man, I don't know if I like where this is going. Right. Because you're hired to get eyeballs. Right. And if that's the way it's going, I'm retiring at the right time. I had been leaning toward it anyway, but I thought, you know, it is time. It's time, you know, let younger people figure out how to deal with this. They will. They're smart, you know, they're. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. You say, how would I have adjusted? Probably not very well. Right. I'm sure I would have figured out something. But it just saddened me that whether it was my column or somebody else's, that more people are just interested in that little. I guess it's maybe always been that way, and it just wasn't as easily available for them to do that. But, then they were debating, what did Draymond mean? He and this reporter got into it, you know, on like the NBA, you know, pregame talk shows, right, or whatever. And, like, oh, man, you know, why don't you talk about, like, what's important? Is when Draymond actually should have punched me the previous summer, because we were in Rio at the Olympics, right? He was on the USA Olympic team. And this is an example of how I sometimes ask questions I probably shouldn't. I don't think I try to have a conversation more than an interview. But anyway, this is, and if you remember, this is the summer when right before, like a month before the Olympics start, he gets in trouble because he has taken a picture of his groin region. Do you remember this? And so groin region feature has been transmitted through, I don't know whether it was Instagram or whatever it was. And so he was in a pickle or in a hot water because of that. And what's that going to mean when they, you know, he's going to be on the Olympic team. What's it going to mean? Was Coach Krzyzewski going to bench him? You know, so now, but he's not available. He was, but now we're in Rio and the basketball team shows up for their first round of interviews. So I'm there, and I don't really know Draymond, but he and I had interactions over the years. I mean, I know, I have pretty good, it doesn't matter, but he and I aren't particularly close, but he knew who I was, or he didn't know my face or whatever. And so we're asking him about this, you know, and he's like going back and forth. And finally, I don't know what got into me. I said, well, Draymond, what's your mom think of this? And he looked at me, and instantly I thought, oh, man, he's going to punch me. But he didn't. And he looks at me and goes, well, why don't you effing ask her? And I said, you know, maybe I will. What's her number? You know? And he says, I'm not going to give you your number. I said, yeah, okay, fine. You know, that was pretty bad of me to ask that question. But on the other hand, what if he said, well, you know, I'll tell you what my mom thinks of it. You know, maybe he would have got a good, I don't know. So that finished up, because what people didn't realize was then, so that exchange he and I have a year later that's on YouTube, right? As he's walking off the platform after this exchange where he's been mad at me and gotten Durant mad at me, he walked off the platform and he's passing my row and I go like, thank you, Draymond. And he looks at me and he winks, right? Like, he's in on it. He knows that I know that he, you know. And I think that's like people don't always understand, I guess, the relationship you can develop if you're in the business that, you know, these guys are smart. Draymond's a smart guy. And, you know, I got in some near scuffles in locker rooms over the years, but it didn't happen very often.
Was there a question that you maybe fought with yourself? Should I ask it? Should I not? And then you bit your tongue and did it anyway, because you know it could be explosive.
Honestly, if you have your brain in this place where I'm not sure I should ask this question, that means you should ask the question.
Yeah.
Right? Because what's the worst that can happen? They're going to get mad at you. And you know, Dan Boyle of the Sharks once came up out of his seat because I asked him, the coach had said, this was when, remember they were ahead 3-0 against the Kings in this playoff series against the LA Kings, and they ended up lost 4, you know, one of the rare times ever a team's had a 3-0 lead in the best of 7 and they end up blowing it. And then, like, after they lost the second game or third game, the coach, Todd McClellan, had said, you know, I don't know if they think they're, you know, we got this one or not, but, you know, we don't. So I asked Dan Boyle, do you think you took your foot off the gas and what's happened? He just, are you saying we're not trying hard? Are you, you know, and he came out and he was, that wasn't on live TV. So I guess it didn't mean, but that, you know, you don't want to get a hockey player mad at you. And
that's a fair question.
But what people didn't see was, so after this explosion, all these reporters around like, oh man, I thought he was going to hit you. And I said, well, I'm not going to take a step back and I'll, you know, he's not going to, you know, my face is worth a lot less than his fist. Right. So I wasn't too worried. But what he didn't see is, like, so after all this clears out, I go up to Dan, I go like, you know, I had to ask that question. I said, are we okay? He said, yeah, I just was really pissed off. I said, I understand. I got an honest reaction from you. That's, you know, that's what you're looking for, right? Who cares about anything else? And the next day we had a talk and it was fine. Candy Maldonado came after me once. You remember Candy Maldonado?
Oh, yeah.
He came after me once in the Giants locker room. Roger Craig, the manager, kind of stepped in and saved my life because Candy was really mad. But that didn't happen too often. And
what axe did he have to grind with you?
Because I had written a column that said, it was a fun column. It was before they were playing the Cubs in the playoff series in whatever year that was, one of those years. And I was doing the column was a fun thing, like, okay, here's the tour of Candlestick Park for the Cubs. You know, you've seen Candlestick Park in the regular season, but in the postseason, it's going to be different. And here's the different places in the park that are going to cause you trouble or not cause you trouble. And one of the things I mentioned was the skid marks in right field, because Candy Maldonado, the outfielder of the Giants, had this habit of, like, diving for balls that he had no chance of catching, right? He would just dive to make it look like he was trying real hard, right? And so he left skid marks across the outfield diving for these balls that he could never get, that he had no chance of getting to. So I would explain, that's what these skid marks are. And you might want to know that, right? So the next day I show up, Candy's on me like, you know, crap on, or stink on crap. And he's going to like, whoa. I go like, whoa, Candy, what are you, you know? And he goes, you wrote that, you say you write, you know? And I'm like, Candy, you know, what is it that I, you know? And so he was upset about that. And I said, well, you know, I know these guys in here tease you about this kind of stuff. He goes, yeah, but those are my guys. And I said, you know, I said, well, I didn't even know, you know, I if you're truly hurt. He says, I'm not hurt, but my family's hurt by it. I said, well, I'll apologize to your family, but this, you're a pro athlete. I'm covering you. This, I can see why you disagree with what I wrote, but this is part of the deal. I said, what got you upset? He goes, well, you know, Will said blah, 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 blah. And I had to stand up to you. And I look over and here's Will Clark, you know, sitting there and he's going like, hee. Like, so Will really put him up to it. At that point, you know, now I am taking a step back because Candy's really hot. And at that point, Roger Craig steps out of his office, steps in and says, hey, what's going on here? You guys come in my office and settle this, man to man, you know. I'm like, what does that mean, right? But he says, you two guys sit down and settle this. So we did. And so that was his beef. And, you know, we got along fine after that. So you just never know. It's like the guys at the sewage plants. Who would ever think, you know, that they'd care so much? But they did. One reason it was a great job. You just never knew. You just never knew what was going to happen day to day. And what you might write might. There was, I did once, this was when I was working in Cincinnati, I did refer to the Bengals cheerleaders as painted ladies once. The Bengals cheerleaders were upset because they, when the Bengals were going to play in the Super Bowl in Detroit against the 49ers, the players, of course, flew, but the Bengal cheerleaders had to take a bus. They were very upset they had to take a bus. So as part of, I don't think it was a whole column, as part of the whole column about how ridiculous it was. The Bengal players, you know, the Bengals cheerleaders are upset about taking a bus ride, you know. Well, it was like a, it's like a 5-hour bus ride. It's not like an all day bus ride. And, you know, I made a joke about, you know, if they spent more time, you know, less time worried about makeup and, you know, the painted ladies. And so they were insulted by that because they thought I was calling them like hookers, which I wasn't, but I do think cheerleaders are kind of a frivolous, accessory to football that aren't really needed. And, well, that was another time. So I wrote a column about, while I was here in San Jose, I wrote a column about cheerleaders and how, because I went and covered a high school playoff game one year. It was when, like, I don't know, there was a baseball strike or something. And then so I ended up covering, I'm going to go out and cover a high school basketball playoff game. And so I show up and the team's cheerleaders aren't there. I said, where are the cheerleaders? I said, well, they've got a competition in Sacramento or something. I said, so the cheerleaders whose purpose is to cheer for the team are not here. Because they're in Sacramento doing something else. And so again, it's kind of a throwaway line. And oh man, these cheerleaders are mad, you know, and they want to come in. They want to come into the office and talk to me. So they come in the office, the whole cheerleading crew comes in the Mercury News office. Sure, I'll talk to you. We sit down in the conference room. They bring their boyfriends who are on the basketball team, right? And they're sitting there and I'm hearing them out. Okay, fine. You know, I was like, the column had just mentioned how useless I thought cheerleaders really were. And so, so I said, well, I don't know, I'm making up a name, Cindy, you know, you really think the cheerleaders are an integral part of, you know, the basketball team winning games, right? Yeah, I do. I said, Billy, do you really think you could possibly win a game if the cheerleaders aren't there? And he goes like, well, yeah, sure, we could. So
they broke up.
Yeah. So now the girlfriend's mad at him. Oh, man. Yeah. And so I felt kind of bad about that. Like, I broke up this lovely high school couple over a column about cheerleaders. So you just never knew. Right. You just never knew. And, you know, what you might write. I'm trying to think of the cases like that where you write something, you don't really see it coming that somebody might be offended by something. But,
you know, in all the years doing this, Mark, did you have some kind of whatever, maybe writer's block? God, what am I going to write about? I've got a column
every day. Every day. I kept like a list of like 50 column ideas. So I would go to one, you know, on a given day. But yeah, I mean, it's Red Smith, another great sports columnist who I was fortunate to meet and sit next to sometimes, you know, he had the best line, you know, writing a column, simple. You just open up your vein and let it bleed for 2 hours. And you can ask my editors, I would grind it out and take it to the last minute right before deadline or sometimes beyond. And because here's the most amazing thing. And this is why I'm so humble, you know, for anybody to take, then or now, to take like 5-10 minutes to read what you have to say, you owe them your best effort, your best sentences, your best paragraphs. You owe them that, and you better every day. You better give them that, because they are owed that. And that was my attitude. I'm going to write. I knew it wasn't possible, right? I'm going to write the best possible column today about this topic, that anybody's ever written, right? Well, you're not going to do that really, but if you got to put yourself in a mindset. So yeah, it was more that than I was fortunate. I was able to come up with, okay, I came up with a lot of stupid ideas too, which is why you got to have good editors. But that was because I saw guys like Jim Murray do that, right? And guys like Dave Kindred, guys I really admired. And so that's what you have to do. And you're not, I've taught classes at San Jose State and Santa Clara. And, you know, I try to explain that, you know, your job is to get people from the first word of the piece to the last word as quickly and effortlessly as possible and make it interesting. So they want to get to the second paragraph and the third paragraph. Where you're not, you can type. All you students are bright enough, you got admitted to these schools, you can type sentences. Do you want to type or do you want to write and engage? That's the trick. And it kind of opens their eyes. When I'll say, like, up to this point, everything you've written, somebody like me or any other teacher, yours has been paid to read. Your mission is to have somebody pay you to read what you write. And you've got to earn that. And that kind of wakes them up, and some of them go into journalism and some of them don't. But you know, that's the attitude I try to bring. And I feel what a immense gratitude I have for that many people took 5 minutes to read what I had to say on a pretty regular basis. And maybe I made them think twice about something. That's amazing to me. And people will come up, I live in San Jose, and people will come up and say, oh, you know, when you wrote in 1997, you wrote this, and I'm like, I don't remember writing that, but somebody remembers that? Amazing. So, if you know any good jokes for my acceptance speech, please send them along.
I absolutely will. Hey, Mark, what do you do with your time now, since you don't have to go to events, you know, around the clock, or watch sports for 10 hours a day?
I've discovered I'm really good at goofing off. I have taught, as I've mentioned. Thank you for asking. When the national football championship game was here at Levi's Stadium between Alabama and Clemson, there was a host committee for that, and they hired me to produce like content for their website and stuff. So I did that. That was fun to be involved in that, kind of see behind the scenes how that machinery all worked. I've written some pieces for the Sharks magazine or different magazines. I wrote a piece for the Santa Clara Alumni magazine where I interviewed Steve Nash. They're great player, who two-time NBA MVP, and he was really thoughtful talking about his time at Santa Clara. I enjoyed that. So people call me up, I'll generally say yes. And I noodled around on some other stuff. I think the main, the days seem to fill up, Dave. I don't know. I think the only people, somebody said this to me once, the only people who are bored in retirement are boring people. And I'm a lot of things. I don't think I'm boring. So I'm doing some, this has been fun. Guy named Dan Orloff, who runs a website called San Jose Rocks about rock and roll in San Jose and the South Bay. And so I'm contributing some stuff to them. It was fun. I got to interview Tyrann Porter, the bassist for the Doobie Brothers. And, you know, that band started out here. He told a lot of great stories about, those days. And they lived in a house on 12th Street and all the crazy stuff that happened there. I'm a big music fan. Not just rock and roll, but all kinds of music. And so that's been enjoyable.
Because we set up this recording before you went on a trip for a couple of weeks. So yeah. Where are you going?
My wife and I are just taking a trip. We're gonna drive. We're going to get up tomorrow morning, and we're going to see where the fires and floods are not. And then we're going to head out on our car. No, the tentative plan is like Eastern Sierras, Utah National Parks. I've never been to those places. So, I haven't... I got it generally planned out.
I think you called her the wife of the year every year.
Wife of the year every year. Absolutely. You know, can you imagine what she had to put up with? I mean, there were some years I was gone like 150, 200 days a year, right? Those years, they used to be the Olympics, summer and winter Olympics were the same year. So that's like 3 weeks in February, 3 weeks in July. And then if the Giants are in the playoffs, that's October. And then in May is the NBA playoffs, and those days I'd go to the Kentucky Derby and the Indy 500 and the baseball All-Star game. And it just seemed like you kind of lurch from event to event. And she raised our kids, did a great job. And I could not have done it without her. I think she had some idea what she was getting into. We met when we were I was in college, or she was in college. I had just gotten out of college and she was my sister's roommate at Miami, Oxford, Ohio. And, I went to school at Northwestern, but one of my first jobs was in Dayton, Ohio, and I covered Miami sports. My sister's younger than me, so that's how we met. And so I was covering sports when she met me and kind of got to see the whole psycho stuff you go through. But we've had some adventures together. Now, she came to of the 14 Olympics, she's probably come to 8 or 10 of them. And, she's a wonderful person. I guarantee I'll probably tear up talking about her because she.
I know you haven't written your speech, but that's got to be part of it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and she's a good person about, yeah. I'm so lucky. We've been married 44 years.
Yeah. From your last call.
How many guys in my profession have been married 44 years?
So, from your last column, August 11th, 2017. Let me tell you a story. If someone in 1984 had informed me as I drove through that Sunol notch that this is exactly how it would turn out, I would have agreed to that deal in a flash.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fantastic. To live in one of the most interesting places on earth, to write about these people I talked about. I mean, I'm just to get to know people like Bill Walsh and, Jack Elway and, I'm amazed. Sometimes I'm amazed that it actually happened because I'm from this real small town in Ohio and, I don't know anybody else that did what I did. Right. So, you just crank out the words every day and amazing things happen. That's all I can say. And I'm grateful to anybody that took 5 minutes to read what I had to say ever. It was an amazing thing to me.
Well, a well-deserved honor. I think about that first, editor of the paper way back when you were a struggling high school athlete, said, I've seen you play. You're right much better than you play.
Yeah. Well, I was a very mediocre high school athlete and that did happen. You know, his name, I got to bring up his name at the speech too. Bob Sherluka. Yeah. He was the sports editor of my hometown paper. And I was, I played behind a guy. I was a backup quarterback to a guy who got a Division I scholarship. So, I was not starting. Right. And, the closest I'd get to the field is like, if his name was Steve Smalley and Steve had a bad series or a bad quarter, then the coach would turn around and say, Purdy, take some snaps with, Lammers, who's my friend, who was the backup center. So we'd be there, by the bench taking snaps. Like the coach wanted Steve to look around and say, oh my God, Purdy's taking snaps. Maybe he's going to come. He was never going to put me in. And so, then the editor of the hometown paper said, I've seen you play. I've seen you write. You write better than you play. Quit the team. Come work for me Friday nights. I'll pay you $15 a story. $15 in 1969 is, 30 cents a gallon gas and $1.25 for the movie. So that was a pretty easy decision. And so I'm grateful to Bob Sherluka for that, who's still alive.
I asked for about 20 minutes, maybe half an hour. We went an hour and 10. So this is awesome, sorry, man.
I didn't mean to.
I wouldn't have ever stopped this.
I hope you can edit it down.
No, I don't want to edit it down. You kidding me? This has been amazing.
Well, I don't know.
I want to congratulate you on a great career. Yeah, sure.
Well, what people need to know is this dinner where I'm in. Don't come there because I'm there. But, George Seifert's going to be there. Summer Sanders, great female swimmer. And James Jones, wonderful. What about that story, Dave? Gunderson High School, and was homeless for a while, lived with his mom in a car or something, and then ended up going to San Jose State, and then the Green Bay Packers wins a Super Bowl. What a story! And so he's going to be there, and Fitz Hill, who was his coach at San Jose State, who I actually ended up writing a book with, you can find it on Amazon called Crackback. It's a book about the challenges facing African American college football coaches. And Fitz is coming in for the dinner.
Good person.
Hopefully for him, not me. But what you need to know is, the dinner benefits Special Olympics and scholarships for student athletes. And, you know, if there's an award for the high school athlete of the year, and that high school then gets some money to go towards scholarships at that school, along with the Special Olympics, which is a highlight of the night. Special Olympian gets up for the award, and not a dry eye on the house when the Special Olympian's accepting that award. So, if you want to attend, you can go to if you just put in your search engine San Jose Sports Hall of Fame dinner, it'll come up, and you can decide whether you want to go. And I think they're almost sold out. But
I have to tell you a quick Special Olympics anecdote. I volunteered to be a timer about 5 years ago in Pleasanton. And so the kid who won the 400-yard race, I timed him. So it's his crowning moment. He's all fired up. So I'm out to congratulate him. And he turns and says, "Cheer her on." Mm-hmm. I said, "What are you talking about?" And he points to the track. And there's one girl that's still struggling to finish the race. She's halfway through, and he wants me to root her on. Yeah. Well, this is his crowning moment. And I said, if this is special needs, give me some of that. The world would be a better place.
These are remarkable people, and they are so deserving and grateful to be a part of this evening. And it shows when they accept the award. And, that always gets to me because these people have been through things you and I can't really fathom. And usually, their parents are there, and it's really an emotional thing. And then dumb guys like me have to get up and follow that with speech about something else. But they should probably end the evening right there. But it'll be fun.
This was awesome. Mark, I want to congratulate you on a great career, and congratulations on that great honor to go into the San Jose Sports Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I'm very, very humbled. And I'll try not to screw it up. All right. Be good. Good luck with everything you're doing. All right. Keep fighting.
Thank you, Mark.
Keep fighting the good fight.
San Jose Sports Hall of Famer Mark Purdy. Our executive producer is Hunter Lewis. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcasts. Your positive comments, the 5-star reviews are huge. They certainly help out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.